This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Monday, April 15th. The world is on edge after Iran fired hundreds of missiles and launched drones on Israel, pushing the two countries to the brink of war. We'll get the latest on the efforts to de-escalate just ahead with Canada's ambassador to the United Nations, Bob Rae. Plus, the Liberal government is set to propose billions in new spending in Tuesday's budget. Coming up, the power panel of water reporters have learned ahead of the big reveal. The long-simmering conflict between Israel and Iran burst out of the shadows this weekend. For the first time, Tehran directly attacked Israeli territory with more than 300 drones and missiles. Casualties were limited. Many of the drones and missiles were shot out of the sky before they could hit their targets. Israel and Iran traded barbs at the United Nations Security Council on Sunday.
This attack crossed every red line, and Israel reserves the legal right to retaliate. We are not a frog in boiling water. We are a nation of lions.
The Israeli Prime Minister's policy seeks to expand and escalate the conflict in the region to stay in power.
Many countries, including Canada, are condemning Iran, but coupled with those denunciations are requests of Israel, please don't strike back.
We think that it is important that Israel be able to protect itself. It has done so over the weekend, and we are clearly pushing for de-escalation, and we need to make sure that the conflict doesn't extend to the region. So that is why I've been clear to my counterpart in Israel, please take the win and make sure that we can work together to bring back peace in the region.
Bob Rae is Canada's ambassador to the United Nations. He joins us now from New York. Bob Rae, it's good to speak with you again.
Thank you, David. Good to be with you.
The Israeli government is insisting it will respond to Iran's attack. Iran says it will respond immediately and more forcefully should Israel do that. From your point, is it possible to contain the situation? Are we on the verge of a wider war here?
Well, I think we have to keep doing whatever we can to try to stop the escalator from going up all ever higher. I mean, of course, if one country says you do this, I'm going to do that, and then okay, then you do this, I'll do that. At some point, we need to understand that this is how wars begin. So let's learn a lesson from that. I saw yesterday in the Security Council open session, which I was able to be at physically, to get a clear sense that there was a huge consensus around the table, with one exception, that there should be no escalation that would take us into the unknown. I think there's a number of voices inside the Israeli cabinet that are saying different things and thinking different things about how to do this. The one thing I do know is this is not a decision that any country, in its own interest or in the interests of its allies, should do anything that's even remotely impulsive. I think we have to be thinking very carefully and consequentially about how to change the dynamic here and how to keep our focus on the situation in Gaza and in the West Bank and the steps we have to take in the near term and in the medium term to get our way through to a different space completely.
You mentioned the Security Council, the U.S., the United Kingdom. They want Israel to slow things down here, avoid escalation. Canada has said pretty much the same thing. And you referenced different perspectives inside the war cabinet in Israel. I wonder what your sense on where the Israeli prime minister is and where his war cabinet is when it comes to the advice not to escalate.
I wouldn't dare to answer that. But I do think that it would be it would surprise me a great deal if there weren't a lot of voices in Israel saying, let's get a handle on this. The Iranian attack, totally unacceptable and totally disproportionate to any concern they had at all with the April 1st attack on the consulate in Damascus. that was not a, the Iranian attack was not successful. It wasn't even remotely successful. And it might have been ambitious, but it had no success. It was a failure. So the question then becomes, well, okay, so let's take it from that point. Let's not pretend that the attack that took place was in some sense a success. From a military and political point of view, it was a complete failure.
So on that point, Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly said she made that point pretty clear to her counterpart in Israel, that essentially this was a failure. Take the win from the weekend. You protected your country. And let's work together now to try to bring peace to the region. Do you have any insight, Ambassador Ray, as to how Israel may have received that message from Canada?
I'm sure we're not the only country telling them this. I think the minister has established some very strong personal relationships with just about every foreign minister in the region, and she makes a point of talking to all of them, which I think is terrific. Frankly, I think it's a great plus for Canada that we've got a minister who's interested in continuing to have these conversations on a regular basis. And I think the candor with which she expressed herself to him, I know, is something that's absolutely critical at this point. I mean, a retaliation is not necessary from a military perspective, from what I can tell. What makes the most sense is to focus on the issues at hand. And I do think that we must keep focused on what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank, because those are the issues that are not going away, that are, according to our information, remain extremely bad as far as the humanitarian situation is concerned. And we need to focus on how do we get to a ceasefire? How do we get the hostages out? That's the path we should be on.
But here we are, Ambassador, where Iran fired directly on Israel, and a failure or not, this wasn't the usual sort of proxy conflict, right? It was hundreds of targets, it were the focus of this, and there's been some suggestion, you called it a failure, some suggestion it was a failure by design, the advance notice and the slow-moving pace to avoid precisely this sort of escalation. I mean, how do you view that dynamic, the nature of this attack from Iran?
Well, I mean, every country, once it's attacked, has to say to itself, well, we can't allow ourselves to be attacked, so we're going to attack back. And so that's what the Iranians said when their senior officers were killed in Damascus. And then 2 weeks later, you have the attack. The only thing I would say is you've got to be sure of who you're dealing with and what the consequences for the next day are going to be. It's one thing to say I want to do this on day one. The question is what happens on day two and day three. And that's why when you say failure or not, the fact that it was a failure, or even the theory that it may have been a planned failure, which I doubt, frankly, is irrelevant. The fact is it was a failure. And the fact is, it didn't work. So you've got to be saying, what do we need to do? Where are the challenges that we face? And in my view, that of course, Iran is always going to be a threat to the region, because that's what they are. But Israel has to think through with all of its allies and reflect through carefully on what steps it's going to be taking. It can't just go off and do it. And I don't think, frankly, I don't think that's what I'm hearing is the direction. The direction, what I'm hearing from different sources, is that Israel will choose its time and it will do what it feels is necessary. And it also means it will be talking to others about how they will be planning things.
So the attack may have been a failure, but it was also a retaliation. I mean, you've referenced the strike in Damascus a couple of times. Iran is accusing Benjamin Netanyahu of seeking a wider war in the Middle East to help him stay in power in Israel. I just wonder, when you look at what happened in Damascus, does Canada think Israel should have done that? That going after what is a consular building was the right move for Israel to do, in given the rules around such things?
Well, I think Canada is a country that plays by the rules. So if you say to us, do we endorse an attack on a consulate in another country? The answer is no, we don't. That's not how we think of. We think international law is important. We don't. That's not what we would do. But you've still got to understand that that was a military objective that Israel had achieved. And then you look at the response and say, well, you're seriously asking me to answer something based on what Iran says. I don't believe Israel's looking for a wider war. I think Israel is looking for every means that it can find to discourage Iran from thinking that it can continue to plan and plot and meet and supply and engage with Hamas, with Hezbollah, with the Houthis, the three H's of the apocalypse. And you can't expect Israel to say, oh, that's okay, we won't watch what they're doing. Israel has excellent intelligence. They have excellent ways of assessing the danger or the risk or who is in the situation. And I don't think Israel is seeking a wider war. I think Israel's problem is that Iran is playing with fire in the region, and that is the problem that we face at the moment.
You said, Ambassador, that the focus needs to remain on what's happening in Gaza and what's happening in the West Bank. And I know Canada has been pushing for a ceasefire, the release of the hostages, and more humanitarian support for the people in Gaza. But Prime Minister Netanyahu said recently that they have picked a date for when the military operations in Rafah are going to happen. I just wonder what your sense is of if there's any chance at this point of... Does it look like Benjamin Netanyahu is keen to get to those conditions that you're looking for, the ceasefire and more humanitarian aid into Gaza, when he's saying things like that about they're picking a date to go into Rafah?
Well, I don't know what Prime Minister Netanyahu is going to do, but more precisely, what the war cabinet in Israel is going to authorize. I don't know the answer to that question. But what I do know is that Canada's view expressed on many occasions by the Prime Minister, by the Minister of Foreign Affairs, by me here at the United Nations, has been very clear. We do not think that a ground-based attack on Rafah is a good idea. We think there should be a ceasefire. We think there should be a release of the hostages. We think we know there has to be an increase in the supply of humanitarian assistance in order to avoid a famine in Gaza. And that, frankly, should be as much concern to the Prime Minister of Israel as it is to all the rest of us. No country can afford to be indifferent to the possibility of a famine as a result of a war which they have participated in. No country can avoid that difficult question. It's something they have to answer.
But even with that fact on the table, Ambassador, I wonder if you think the Prime Minister and his war cabinet are interested in peace on conditions that are anything less than the total victory that they've told the Israeli people they're trying to deliver.
What I do know for a fact is that Israel has engaged in a number of intense discussions with Hamas and with Egypt and with Qatar and with the United States, that they've sat around a table, that they have tried to find solutions. And I believe that those pressures are still there. So if you say to me, you know, is that not happening? It is happening. You wouldn't be doing this unless you wanted to find an answer. And I know that anybody in public life in Israel has to be concerned about getting the hostages out. I just think that's a common tragedy, an atrocity, that the country is preoccupied with. So why wouldn't they deal with that? They have to make every effort to deal with it. I'm not saying they control the outcome. I'm not saying that Hamas is a beneficent organization. It's not. It's a terrorist organization. But they have released hostages in the past, and I think there is still a deal that can be done. But it's up to the parties to decide whether or not they're going to do it. But if the alternative to that is to say, okay, now let's go after them in Rafah, I think the humanitarian consequences of that and the political consequences of that would be very, very serious for everybody. And I don't think it's something that should happen.
Hamas has been designated by Canada as a terrorist organization. And in the wake of this launch of these attacks on Israel, there's a renewed push in Parliament today for Canada to designate the IRGC as a terrorist organization. Is Canada prepared to do that? Do you think Canada should do that, sir?
Well, I think that's a question that should be answered by House of Commons. How's that?
All right. I thought you might give me that answer, but I figure I'd take my shot anyway. Bob Wray, Canada's ambassador to the United Nations. Always appreciate the time. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Today, Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland continued the very Canadian tradition of selecting a new pair of shoes ahead of the budget. The annual spending plan is usually shrouded in secrecy, but the Liberal government spent the last couple of weeks rolling out the key planks largely related to housing. I'm joined now for more details by my colleagues, Radio Canada's Parliamentary Bureau Chief Louis Blouin and the CBC's Karina Roma. Good to see you both.
Hey.
Hi.
So, Louis, you guys have a story up this morning on Radio Canada about tax increases coming in this budget tomorrow. What are you hearing about that?
We know that the big question tomorrow is the fiscal anchors that the finance minister set last spring, last fall. Could she remain committed to that? We know that they have to bring in revenues. So what they are targeting is rich people in Canada. They want to tax some wealthy Canadians more. What we're told is that it's going to be a very small percentage of the Canadian population, less than the 1% that we are talking about. So, and it's not the first time that they've done that. You know, last year they raised the minimum tax that limits the tax advantages you can get when you file your tax return. So they could go that way. They could go the way of taxing more capital gains. That could be another option, or maybe simply having a new bracket of imposition. So we will see the details for that tomorrow. We are also hearing that the Liberals want to make some fiscal changes for big businesses in Canada,
right,
to bring in also more revenues. So could it go as far as what the NDP is asking, this tax on excessive profits of oil companies, big grocery chains in Canada? The signal that we receive is that they're not necessarily ready to go there. But we will see how far they go, because they have a balancing act to do there. They don't want to be counterproductive and, you know, just push away investment in Canada at a time where, you know, growth is kind of not what we hope for. So it's going to be a delicate exercise tomorrow, what they're doing. Right. But they want to send the signal that they want to bring in more money.
Right. So after the weeks of the spending announcements, it's targeting the 1% richest of Canadians in some form or another, either capital gains, stock options, alternative minimum tax, or a new tax bracket. We don't know which. Yep. And on the corporate side, something, but maybe not the windfall tax or a base increase.
Yep.
What about the digital services tax? Louis, this is something they want to bring in for the big tech companies. They've announced it, legislated it, but they've never put it into force.
Exactly.
Do we know what's happening there?
We asked, could it be that? Because we were wondering, because this could be an option to get in more revenues. What we were told in the background is that it's already announced. Maybe we're going to get some details about how it's implemented, but it's not the news we're looking for.
Okay.
So we'll see.
All right. So, Karina, Louis talked about a balancing act that needs to be done here, you know, on the ledger between, you know, expenses and revenues. But also there's this balancing act the federal government has with the budget and how the Bank of Canada feels about this budget as they're trying to get to a sustainable low interest rate environment and not cause any more rate hikes.
Exactly. Everyone I've talked to has said they have to send a signal of fiscal responsibility. Now, perhaps fiscal responsibility and restraint is in the eye of the beholder, but the Bank of Canada is looking for, are we ready to start lowering rates? And they're only going to be ready to do that if, as Chrystia Freeland has said many times, they don't pour more fuel on the fire. Mm-hmm. So you've got all these spending announcements, although they say, you know, $38 billion that we've heard so far, but $17 billion of that being a loans program, so it's not, you know, it has to be taken into account. Still, it's a lot of money. So will that be seen as restraint? What more will we see tomorrow? How will they pay for it? All of that is sending a signal to lower those rates. And why is that important? Well, obviously, Canadians would like to see lower rates. Mm-hmm. But politically, really, if the Liberals want to not further fall in the polls, they'd like to see, you know, those rates go down too, because that will only help, not hurt, you know, their political fortunes as well. So that's the balancing act they're also doing. They want to, you know, help people and make life more affordable and all of that and deal with these cost of living crises, but they also don't want to make it worse by causing inflation to go up. So they have to tread that line.
Right. It's a balancing act, Karina, but it's definitely not going to be a balanced budget, right? I mean, we know that categorically, because what they're talking about now as a target, as a measure of fiscal restraint, despite despite this, all of this new money, it's to sort of keep the deficit at 1% of GDP, sort of below $40 billion as a sign of modesty in terms of spending. With all the money they've done, some of it loans, as you said, how do they do that? I mean, there's not going to be enough on the taxation side, given what Louis has said about it. Like, what kind of a balancing act did they do?
So the other balancing act is, it depends on how immediate all the spending will actually roll out, right? So maybe a lot of it is backloaded. Maybe there's other spending promises. And it's been pointed out to me that there's a number of measures in previous budgets that actually haven't happened yet. So is there a reprofiling? Is there a delay in spending in other priority areas, since everything seems to be a priority with this government, that they then, you know, push the numbers? I mean, what it matters is to them, I presume, when you're looking at those guardrails to keep the deficit in a certain range, is on paper, what is it going to look like? But what will that mean in reality? So is it deferred spending? Some of the defense spending, a lot of the defense spending is quite deferred. But what other things have they promised in the past that may be now later, or things they're even promising now that people will say, oh, surprise, it's not actually going to happen next year. That would be another way for them to make the numbers work.
I'm curious to see where the Trans Mountain Pipeline plays into the revenue projections. It's coming on stream in May, and that could boost oil prices. So that's obviously a big factor there. But Louis, look, it's been weeks of talking about housing, millennials, and Gen Z, or Gen Z, depending on how you want to pronounce it. I mean, that's who they're targeting in this budget, right? It's younger voters who are angry and disillusioned, and they need them back.
And that's why I think we can call this an electoralist budget, even if maybe the election is 1 year away, a year and a half. They are targeting young voters that are struggling to get into the housing market, for sure. There's a lot of frustration out there. And it's been showed by a lot of young people going to Pierre Poilievre. The poll shows it in the 18 to 35-year-olds bracket. People are very, very worried. So it's the thematic that is coming out of all this, and the Prime Minister repeated it today. He's fighting about fairness between generations. So that's the big message you're going to hear tomorrow. But the thing is, we've seen all this buffet in the last 2 weeks. Tomorrow we're going to see the bill. So and the thing is, for me, is that is it being fair for the next generation to, if the next generation is footing the bill? So I think they have to send a signal that they're trying to control their spending, but also that they are listening to what's happening on the ground, and that's people not being able to enter the market and are paying too much money for their rent.
Yeah, it's a piece of cake. It's an angry country with big problems that requires big spending, and you need to do that without driving up the deficit and not raising taxes to the point where you choke off the economic recovery. Yeah. Piece of cake. All right, so, you know, Karina Roman, Louis Blouin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, after weeks of budget week, tomorrow is actually budget day on Parliament Hill, and opposition parties have their own economic priorities on deficit reduction and corporate taxes.
They're not worth the cost, and now their deficits are driving up the interest obligations for the average family. For a family with a $500,000 mortgage, deficits are adding 10 grand in additional interest payments per year.
We know that corporate greed is a major driver that's pushing up the cost of living. We want to see concrete actions to take on this corporate greed and make them pay their fair share.
The government, however, has already laid out much of its fiscal plan with a series of pre-budget news conferences. Most of the early announcements have focused on one key priority, housing, with many initiatives aimed at boosting construction, including more than $20 billion in new spending and loans for home and apartment construction, with the aim of building 3.9 million new homes by 2031. There are also new measures targeting homelessness to protect renters and to help first-time homebuyers get into the market. Another key focus, children and families, with a billion-dollar loan program to expand child care centers, student loan forgiveness for rural and remote child care workers, $500 million to launch a youth mental health fund, and another billion to launch a national school food program. Other areas the government has previewed its spending plans for include an $8.1 billion investment in Canada's military over the next 3 years, increasing the tax credit for volunteer firefighters from $3,000 to $6,000, and $2.4 billion to build capacity in the field of artificial intelligence. Got to wonder if there's going to be anything left to talk about tomorrow. Let's bring in the power panel today, though. Rob Russo is the former CBC Parliamentary Bureau Chief. Brad Levine is a former Communications Director for the NDP. And here with me in the studio, Vandana Cotter is a former advisor to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and Gary Keller is a former Chief of Staff to Conservative Cabinet Ministers. Happy Budget Eve, gang. Vandana, it was a rare day. There was no actual pre-budget announcement today. It's like they broke a streak. $38 billion in multi-year commitments, $17 billion of that in loans, but $21 billion in new spending. How are they going to do all of this and not blow past that deficit ceiling they've set for themselves?
Well, I think they definitely have a way to do it. I mean, Minister Freeland has said that she's creating the conditions to make sure that the Bank of Canada can bring down interest rates. I think the government knows that the best thing that will work for them is if the Bank of Canada brings down those rates. So whatever they need to do. But I do think what they're going to look at is they're going to prepare to set up an argument that will work, I think could work for them well for the election, which is investing in Canadians. And they're going to put forward an argument that talks about, you know, here's what we're going to do for you. And you can bet on this. You can bet on a government that has your back, that's going to focus on housing, that's going to focus on healthcare, and the issues that matter to you the most right now in a time of affordability. We are looking at an economy that is affected still by the pandemic, a global war in Ukraine that is affecting not only just Canada, but, you know, the U.S. and Europe. So this is happening across the world. But, you know, for them to say, here's what we're going to do for you, and to put the question, what do you think the opposition will do for you? So I think that'll work for them.
Well, Gary, you know, my colleagues at Radio Canada and others have been speculating, and they're reporting it today, that there are going to be tax increases in this budget tomorrow to help balance things out, aimed at the wealthiest of Canadians and in some way at corporate Canada, though we're unclear as exactly what that will look like. What are your expectations on there?
Well, it's interesting the clip you just played there, because I think there was something for everybody in that messaging. So you had, you know, the government talking about their announcements to date. You had Mr. Polyev talking about the impact of the rising interest rates and government spending. You know, he's always talked about, you know, lower government spending, lower interest, it'll be better in the pocket, in your pocketbook. Mm-hmm. And then Mr. Singh talking about corporate greed, which is again in line with his message. But, you know, the things that the Liberals have been talking about for the last 2 weeks and we'll be talking about tomorrow, Mr. Polyev has been talking about for 8, 9, 10, 12 months. And the question will be, I think, for a lot of voters, to Vandana's point, is, okay, you say you're there for us now. Where were you for the last year when things got completely out of control? And sure, the government can make all sorts of arguments about interest rates and what have you, but Mr. Polyev, it goes right to his key argument about government spending. Got to get government spending down, pay less interest, more for programs. And so I think there is some messaging for everybody, no matter how you look at it.
But Brad, you know, the balance sheet, the Bank of Canada, the bond raters are going to be less interested in messaging and more interested in the bottom line, right? So Chrystia Freeland is saying fiscal restraint, productivity growth, and addressing affordability and housing are all the core targets of their last or second last budget before the election, depending on when it is. I mean, how does she strike that balance and like nod to all the problems that need to be addressed and nod to all the demands that their confidence and supply partner are putting on the table?
Well, I think what we've seen over the last couple of weeks is where the spending is going to go. And that's a tough message because there's many priorities. And when you have many priorities, it's hard to grab the attention of the country who will be tuning in for tomorrow's budget and the day or two afterwards to say what is the storyline here. I think every budget has to have a very tight message. Is this a housing budget? Is this a budget for slow economic times, which I think many are predicting? I'm not rooting for it, but that's certainly what the experts are calling for. So the only thing left to really talk about is how is she going to pay for it? Mm-hmm. And you know, to your setup there, I think, you know, corporate income taxes. I wouldn't be surprised if you saw corporate income taxes addressed by either an increase to the corporate income tax itself, or maybe a narrow cast of a windfall profits tax. While many Canadians are struggling with high costs, whether it's food or housing, some of our companies in this country have done very well and are making record profits. So the question is, will they be called upon to play a role in how to offset some of this program spending? And then, of course, in the weeks and months to come, what are the reactions from the bond raters and the Bank of Canada on all that? If the Bank of Canada does bring down interest rates, that'll be good news for the incumbent government federally, because that will relieve a lot of Canadians who are paying much more for their mortgages today than they were just a couple of years ago. So the runway isn't long. This is, as you say, this is either the second or the last budget that at least be fully at least implemented before the next federal election. Not a lot of time to get those programs into the hands of Canadians so that then the election question becomes, do you like these programs or will Pierre Poilievre take them away? That's a ballot question right now at this early stage within the election cycle.
You know, Rob, when you were my boss here as a bureau chief at the CBC, the day before the budget, you'd be ordering us to make phone calls and find out what's going to be in this thing. Hard to do that this year when they've announced everything for weeks in advance running up to it. But, you know, we are getting reporting that there's going to be some sort of tax measures in the budget tomorrow. I mean, how do you think this narrative could all play out based on what they've rolled out so far and the blanks they're going to fill in tomorrow?
Given what they're going to spend and given what Minister Freeland has said about sticking to deficits and sticking to, I think they call them anchors again. They were guardrails for a while after they were anchors and now they're anchors again.
Anchors away.
Note that they never really hit. They never really hit any of their targets, but they're going to have to inflict some pain. And how do you do that if you're a government a year away from an election? How do you inflict pain? I think we're about to find out that populism isn't just the preserve of the right in Canada. It can also be used on the left. I think we're going to see them go after people who are very wealthy. It could be everything from, 1%ers, or it could be there's about to be a huge transfer. It's already started of wealth from baby boomers to their kids. If you could pick an arbitrary number like 5 million, you might want to get a slice of that for everything over 5 million. It's not a lot of money, probably, but it sends a signal that that you're going after people who have a lot of money, and it might be popular as well. I don't know. I couldn't get back into Ottawa because there was a line of Brinks trucks going down Bank Street. I thought that was because you were cashing out there, David.
Yeah. No, I return my empties. Look, Vandana, I wonder about this. Like, Rob talks about populism not just being the domain of the right. And if you go back to the 2015 campaign, when the Liberals talked about class, they did well. When they talk about values, they don't do as well. Is this a shift back to a class-based argument if they're going after wealthy Canadians through the tax system? Sort of like the first thing we did, Justin Trudeau used to say, was cut taxes for the middle class and raise them on the 1%.
Yeah, that was the most popular policy that we put out. I remember I went on my honeymoon 3 weeks after the election, and it's what people, Canadians, were talking about. It's the only thing they remembered. So I do think the government does know that when they talk about values, it doesn't always connect with people the same way. But talking about things that affect people in a more tangible way will work. And I think for most people, being the 1%, or if you're like a corporate person in Loblaws, you know, you think, you know what, I can't get that ahead. I think most people that are my cohort, which are millennials, think that I work hard, I do my job, I pay my bills, but I cannot seem to save enough. But then there's a whole slot of people that seem to be able to get ahead. And not to, you know, I don't want to, you know, there's nothing wrong to do well. You know, whether you work hard, your industry, you have intergenerational wealth, there's a number of reasons to, but I think it connects to pocketbook issues that affect Canadians where you're like, okay, you're not hurting me. You're going to provide me with healthcare, with housing, you're going to give an environmental plan, but you're going to go to whatever, if it is a tax hike for corporations with 1%, right, that's not going to affect the average middle class Canadian. And I do think for people of a certain segment, the ones that they're after, the middle class, you know, Gen Z, and for millennials, that is something that will be quite interesting for them.
So Gary, there's a challenge here for the government, right, in that the economy, while slow, has done better than some of the doomsday scenarios that we were all hearing coming out of. The recession is coming, it's evident. It feels like a soft landing. It has been achieved or is likely, though it's very flat. I'm not saying it's happy times, but it's not, you know, multiple quarters of negative growth, right? Wages have been above inflation for a good chunk of time right now, but people aren't feeling any better off because when you get the wage increase, you want to have the buying power that goes with it, and people aren't getting that. So they've told everyone what's in the budget. They need to make everyone feel what's in the budget, and that is a difficult thing for our government to do at this stage.
And I think that's why Mr. Poilievre has been so successful to date. He has been representing back to people the exact feeling that they have been feeling. I attended one of his rallies about 3 weeks ago here in Ottawa, just in the back of the room, just to watch the crowd. First of all, I was struck by a few things. One was the number of people who I've never seen before at a Conservative rally in Ottawa, the number of young people, the number of diverse people, just people who had never been to a political event before and were clearly enthused by the messages he was on talking about. It doesn't feel like you're ever getting ahead. And Mr. Polyev ends all his speeches with that sort of imagery, the family that is finally at home, the kids playing road hockey on the street, the seniors planting, you know, flowers at the cenotaph, but the young family who are sitting on their front steps saying, "We're home finally." And if people can't feel like they can afford that core thing, which is a house or an apartment or some sort of a shelter, that is going to continue to dog the government all the way through until the next election.
Well, Brad, on that, we saw, we released on Friday a pretty comprehensive pulling together of a housing plan. That's not my assessment of it. That's the assessment from the people who work in that particular space, saying what you have there is essentially a collection of a lot of the best ideas that a lot of the people who have been thinking about this for a long time have been putting out there. And it's funded. It just needs cooperation and help from the provincial and municipal governments. And the provincial governments, that's a work in progress, I think it's safe to say. But all of that's going to take some time. So how do you make this land beyond a better communication strategy, as people seem to think, this year? They've got to start feeling it in their bones, in their wallets, and in their homes for this to matter.
Well, that's why, in some respects, there's not enough time for all of that housing to get built. These are multi-year plans. We don't have the supplies, we don't have the labor, we don't have the plans in place to build everything before the next federal election. So, you know, again, that's why the interest rate in June, whether those come down or not, we have a significant portion of mortgage holders who are renegotiating in the upcoming months. If there's not relief for them, they're going to be in a very, foul mood. So it doesn't matter if they see construction going on everywhere. It's not affecting them per se. And unless people are moving from rental housing on the housing continuum into first-time home buying capacity, unless they're moving, they're not going to feel it in their bones. So this really comes down to the story that you're telling. I mean, I don't want to place everything on comms, because I do believe that there is a bundle of programs there that some of the best and brightest in the country put together, and the government seems to have adopted those plans. We can argue that it's far too late, and I would certainly be part of that. But the story that has to come out of this budget has to be that there is a plan in place and that things are about to get better. To Gary's point about, like, Polyev is winning not on ideas, he's winning on story. His story is far more powerful, tapping into far more Canadians than Trudeau's or Singh's storyline. So if he's got the better policy, then the only thing that's left really is the story that he's got to tell, and he's only got about 12 to 18 months to tell it in a compelling way to grab those people and say, there is a game plan and I am your best hope for a better future in the upcoming mandate, as opposed to Mr. Polyev.
Okay, but Rob, just on that, the story that's being told, the storyteller has not been the Minister of Finance and Deputy Prime Minister. It's been Sean Fraser. It's almost like this is his budget in a big way, at least on the spending side measures that are at the centerpiece of the narrative they're pitching.
And I think everybody will acknowledge that he's an excellent communicator. So I don't think that's any accident at all. I think if you ask Liberals, though, the problem is the Prime Minister, that he continues to have very little capital on which to draw on when he's trying to sell these ideas. And I'm with Brad as well. I think hope is what's required. This budget needs to signal hope. And I think they need to probably go beyond what's in the budget now. If people in that sort of 30 to 45 category who are looking to buy a home, looking to get out of their apartment, looking to get out of their condo, are going to go ahead. And there was an interesting study put out today by Mike Moffat, the housing economist. He said upwards of 20% of the cost of a home are taxes and fees. And the federal government has some sway there. I would be interested in seeing if they can reduce taxes and urge other levels of government to do that in a dollar-for-dollar basis, and see if that lurches down or notches down the cost of a home. I would look for something like that, something beyond what we've heard now, in order to try and tap into some hope.
Yeah, I know in the infrastructure money they put on the table, one of the conditions for getting it is no increase in development fees for 3 years, I believe, for municipalities and provinces to do that. So that's one way that they're trying to build new homes. And today we saw the finance minister get some new shoes. Because Chrystia Freeland, she took part in this tradition, a Canadian tradition of getting a new pair of shoes in which to deliver the budget.
Okay. C'est parfait. Merci beaucoup.
Ça va bien.
So these shoes are from a company founded by Millennial and Gen Z Canadians, two cohorts that are a big focus, really the sole focus of this upcoming budget. So Gary, I want to talk about the politics of this, right? Because there's the story everyone's trying to tell, and there's the storytellers who are trying to tell it. That's your audience, in particular, in a lot of ways, Gen Z, Millennial, and women. The Liberals are underwater with men. It's a gender and generational play. They are. You're not going to disagree with me. I'll come to you right after, Gary. But it's a gender and generational play, and is the budget the way you can do this?
It's one of the ways you can do it. I'll just say my favorite budget tradition was John Crosby's mucklucks.
His mucklucks, yeah. That budget didn't go so well.
That budget didn't go so well with an 18-cent a gallon increase on gas. But no, you're absolutely right. It's one step, but to some of the previous comment about the time getting short, it's not 12 to 18 months. They have to start making serious inroads now, between now and June, so that by the time they hit the barbecue summit circuit this summer, they are, you know, continuing to eat away and eat away and eat away at those leads. Mr. Polyev has had between a 10 and 20 point lead every single poll. It doesn't matter who's doing it, what's doing it, since July of last year. And that signals, like, these numbers are baked in. And so how do you reverse that? Well, you got to start somewhere. And I think, obviously, budget day is one way to do that, which is why they chose a different method of rolling out the announcements. It's different. We saw Danielle Smith do a little bit of the same thing in Alberta. She bought time on primetime TV to announce some budget measures. But you got to start somewhere. But, like, 12 to 18 months, way too late. They've got to start seeing some numbers movement, you know, May, June, before trying something else.
So Vandana, your arms are not wide when I said they're underwater with male voters, but, you know, it is a reality right now for the Liberal Party. So, like, what do you make of this acute focus on Gen MZ, as they're calling them internally? I understand in the shorthand of government, the millennials and the Gen Zs.
I was putting my hands out because you covered all my themes.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to scoop you.
I think, you know, what Gary said earlier was right. I think Pierre Poilievre has done a really good job in connecting with that generation, mainly because he's talking about the issues they care about on housing, on, you know, this is a generation that isn't going to go work in some place in corporate Canada and, like, work for their pension for their life. Like, they're looking at the gig economy. They're looking at so many different things. So, and they want to live where they want to live, whether that's Mississauga, whether it's somewhere else, but they don't want to be, you know, have to be like, well, I can only rent or I can only live over here. They want to have the same life that maybe their parents have, should they wish. And I think the focus on that is going to be really important. But the Prime Minister, from the beginning, in 2015, I remember when we were in opposition, his main focus was on youth. And those youth are older now, right? And I think we need to also understand that there's next generation that hasn't been connected with the Prime Minister, and they've only known him as the establishment, whereas before he was the anti-establishment, right? So I think it's about, you know, reconnecting with that grouping. I think that's why you have millennials. I think Sean's about my age. Like, I mean, to send that message. And I think someone who can connect with them, who's relatable to them, will be helpful. But that is one of the biggest voting blocks right now.
Yeah.
And millennials they're not as young as they used to be. They tend to be, they have partners, they have children, they want a home. But you also have to go to, like, the next generation, the Gen Z. And what Rob said was right. They want hope. They don't want to hear negative. They don't want to be, you know, cynicism can be exhausting. So, you know, where can they bet on that can give them the future that they want and can understand the future in the lens of which they see it?
Right. So Brad, here we are, a couple of Gen Xers, sidelined again in another federal budget. But, Brad, on that, like, giving hope is one thing, but you have to draw the contrast with the guy who's been given hope by harnessing the anger, right? And I don't say that pejoratively, it's just what has happened. We haven't seen in-depth policy solutions from Mr. Poilievre yet on the number of issues he's talked about. There have been a few things about really leveraging the municipalities to do what he feels they should be doing. How do you draw that contrast in an aggressive way that you need to do with an election cycle coming without feeding into the cynicism that Vandana is talking about when you're trying to offer that message of hope? Because when your negatives are high, like they are, you need to bring the other guy down if you can't really bring yourself up.
Yeah, especially if you've made the decision that you're going to be leading your party into the next election campaign. There comes a point in the cycle when you're so far along. This is now, you know, it's been, you know, 8, 9 years. He's going to be coming up to 9 years. That's hard for any politician in this country at the federal level, even at the provincial level. And I know from my own experience, when you're in a government that's very unpopular, then you've been in power for a long time, it's really hard to change the channel, even if you've got the contrast. But so the question is, will anybody be listening? Do people want to listen? This is why the Minister of Housing is the lead on the policy and not the Prime Minister, because I think a lot of people are tuning Trudeau out. They don't want to hear him anymore. So that's a real problem. So you either change a leader or you punt the policy lead and the story lead to others. I don't think Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland is the best communicator within this government right now. Fraser certainly, to Rob's point, a very effective communicator. But you can't drag a government up from the housing minister. At least it hasn't been done in history. So the big challenge is anybody listening, and what will it take to change channel? But you need contrast. You need to. So once you pass the budget, or once you've finished your budget day, you got to go out and sell it, and you got to say, we're going to do this. They're going to do that. Our messages of hope. He wants, you know, we want to build up. He wants to tear down. That's not cynical. I think we're going to have to draw the eye over to what the options are. Again, Gary's point is right. I mean, he doesn't have 18 months to turn it around. He's got 18 months before the next election. So he's got to turn it around well before that. But the contrast can't come fast enough. We've been saying on this panel that the Liberals should have been out ages ago. They let Polyev off scot-free. He had the field to himself. He's defined himself, right? I mean, I take Vandana's point about, you know, if Justin Trudeau can become anti-establishment, that's a hell of a marketing coup. But there's still time to pivot and talk about. Now that you've got the policy, tell the story of hope. Go back and say this. You know, Polyev's going to take it all away. Meanwhile, Singh can point to all the things that he's done in this parliament with his 25 members of parliament, and he can offer a better option as well. So it won't just be the two of them. Singh's got a role here, and Blanchette in Quebec will also play a role in that crowded market space. But you can't do without contrast. It might be too late, but there's still time, I think, to at least try close the gap from those 10 to 20 points and make it a fairer fight come fall.
So, but Rob, you know, on the contrast, there's going to be a balancing act of competing interests in this budget, but there's not going to be a balanced budget, and there may not even be a path back to balance. And one of the things that Pierre Poilievre has successfully prosecuted is the idea that federal deficits and federal spending, was in the clip we set this up with, are a reason inflation is high and interest rates are high, even though the inputs into that calculation go far beyond what the federal budget is. Provincial budgets, municipal budgets, global factors, it's a whole bunch of things. Can you battle back on that contrast? If you've still got a deficit there of like $40 billion, this is kind of the ceiling they're planning to stay within. And, you don't control the interest rates, you don't control inflation, but you're being blamed for these things.
I think given the level of despair and distemper out there, there's less concern about deficits than there is about doing something to give people a sense of optimism. And all you have to do is look at Conservative governments at Queen's Park and in Quebec to know, they brought in far larger deficits than expected because they know that they have to address the existential threat to their mandates. And that's people's discontent and distemper right now. So I take Madam Freeland at her word when she says she's going to come in with a deficit no bigger than what she promised at $40 billion, she's going to have to get that money from somewhere else. I'd like to go back, though, and talk about this notion of how much time we have. Everybody's talking about a year and a half. Yeah. I'm not sure. I think this budget is designed that they could campaign on this budget if they needed to. And I think that we're coming to the end of the confidence and supply agreement. I don't know that there are very many other demands out there that the NDP might have. I think that we're about to see a declaration that that's over fairly soon.
You think the NDP are ready to walk away from this? I mean, their numbers ain't great, you know?
Yeah. I don't know what else they're getting out of this deal right now. I don't know what fresh demands they may have. I'll be listening for them. I think that they'll probably end up voting for this budget. But then I wonder if the separation, the divorce that is inevitable. All of these parties have to begin to draw lines. The NDP needs to begin to draw lines of distinction. And they got what they got. They can campaign on it. we can debate the merits of it, but they need a divorce. Mm-hmm. And I think that the liberals are preparing for that as well. Now, that doesn't mean the government's going to fall. We all know nobody has the balance of power, but it does make things a little less stable than they have been for the last 3 years.
Gary, it seems to me like Tiff Macklem may have a bigger say in the timing of the next election than Justin Trudeau, right? Like what he does in June, what he does in July, and what he does in the months after that, because they need the economy to get better. They need TMX to start changing the equation when it comes to oil prices. They need these housing starts to get going so people can see some hope and the mortgage amortizations to take effect. And they need interest rates to come down. Because that's when it all uncoupled for them. When the rates went up, they collapse. If they start to go down, they need an external inflection to change things for them.
It's not the only thing, but it's a major factor. And they need to see interest rates come down over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And whether or not that is in the game plan, that seems... Look, I'm expecting one rate decrease. Am I expecting multiple rate decreases over month to month to month? I don't know about that.
Well, it's not going back to the essentially free money that has existed for the past decade. That's done.
But like, in order for people to see a difference in their monthly mortgage payment, you need to see quite a few points drop before people will start to see that, which again takes time. Yeah. To Rob's point about the divorce proceedings, I do think that is inevitable as well. To me, there also may be a window this fall. The big question, though, is have the Liberals been able to narrow the gap? If it's still 10, 20 points, why would you go to an election then? Can you pull the plug yourself like you did the last time in 2021? I think a government gets to do that once. Stephen Harper tried in 2008. He didn't get his majority. Justin Trudeau tried in 2021. He didn't get his majority. So I think you need to engineer a crisis, a budget crisis or a confidence crisis to defeat yourself. And then you've got the fall. You can throw in the mix of the U.S. election. And I still maintain that part of the Liberal strategy is, can we tie Donald Trump to Pierre Poilievre as much as possible? It's a risky strategy. David McNaughton, former Canadian ambassador to the U.S., said, this is a very risky, I don't like this, but it is a strategy. So I still think I would be surprised to see those numbers shrink that quickly, which then means you're probably into spring 2025 at the earliest.
So, Vandana, it seems, as tough as times have been, through the peak inflation and interest rate hikes of the past little while, looking forward, the dynamics do look better for the economy overall and, as such, the government itself. So it seems stretching this out might help change the map a bit for them.
Yeah, I think the government knows that it's been a difficult time for Canadians, and Canadians just need to feel better. They need to feel, I'm not sure if they'll necessarily see how big a change, but if they see a change, they get a bit more money back. They see, grocery stores is not as expensive. I think, and evidently, people just generally feel better about the economy. I think they know it's their best bet, and I don't think it's a one or two approach. I think it's a multi-pronged approach. I think, they know they need time to up those numbers. That's why they need a shift in the budget. They want to change that. They want to close that gap. They want to connect. I think they're testing out who their best communicators are on the front bench and who can best connect with Canadians, because the PM will always have his base. But for those who don't want to see him, who else is out there? We have a strong front bench, right? So I think there's that. I think, waiting for the economy to get better. I think they really will want to show that they can implement and deliver some of those key components. So getting some housing build, pointing to like success stories. And then, I think their third, but not a big strategy, maybe a small one, is if, yes, Trump gets elected. I'm not sure that's a comparison tool, but more of a, this is a government that's dealt with him before tool. This is a government that is stable, and you know what you're getting here. So, you can depend on this government and give them a shot.
Brad, I'm not sure if you're doing any marriage counseling in this confidence supply marriage that Rob was talking about. But what's your sense on this? I mean, Jagmeet Singh is doing something on consumer carbon pricing. I'm not clear what it is, and I don't think we're going to get clarity until after David Eby has his election in British Columbia. But what's your prognosis on how long the supply and confidence agreement might go, and if the budget could affect that?
Well, once this budget passes fully, then there's unlikely to be another motion of confidence until the next budget. So that's a full year from now.
Well, who knows?
But
you've got estimates. You got a fall economic statement budget bill that'll come forward. So there are triggers there if they want.
Yeah, they're not going to prorogue and have another throne speech. There could be opposition motions that call for the government. We did that a lot in the 7 years between 2004 and 2011. We did that almost once a month. I think it was a monthly affair. Very tiring for those that were in the trenches. But you could elegantly end and say we've gotten what we wanted to, but now it's time to separate. And then that would free up Singh to go full throttle against the Trudeau and the Liberal government and kind of take out the sting that Singh has had to, you know, wear with an unpopular government, yet it was the NDP that kept voting for it. Now, other opposition parties have voted for unpopular governments in the past. I mean, my goodness, the Bloc supported Mr. Harper for many years. Mr. Ignatieff supported Mr. Harper for many, many confidence votes. So you can delink, but it would be, I think, a fundamental mistake to wait so long that between the time that the CASA does finish and the election time, that there's not enough time to separate yourself. You have to calculate, you know, do you have eight to 12 months between the election and the end of the CASA? That way you get all of the benefits, but then you try to take out the sting in the upcoming election. So something in the near term could be very important.
Rob, just a quick final thought from you, if I can, that no matter what's in this budget tomorrow, there is this trend right now in Western democracies where incumbents are just in trouble, no matter what they do and no matter what the underlying circumstances are. So how do you – is this the beginning of a possible path back against what appears to be just a global sentiment right now?
Well, the odds are against historic odds at Canada since Lester Pearson – we have tended to toss governments out after 9 or 10 years. So the odds are not with the government. That being said, the government has decided, as we noted last week, to actually come out of its inert state, which is what it was in really for several months during the summer, and get in and get in the game. And what have they done? Well, they've gotten a couple of weeks of free airtime. I'm going to be interested. If we're going to, I'm going to be looking for ads. I'm going to be looking for ads after the budget. The Liberal Party has not spent any real money on advertising on television. I can't watch anything. I can't watch a movie. I can't watch a sporting event without a conservative ad, even from the government of Ontario, which isn't going to the polls for a long, long time. They're telling me how wonderful that it is to live in Ontario. They're not partisan ads. But those guys are spending money on ads. Are we going to see the Liberal government do the same thing? I'll be watching for that after the budget as well.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a break. Let's see if you see a conservative ad on the other side of this. I want to thank you, thank the Power Panel. Rob Russo, Brad Levine, Vanda DeCotter, and Gary Keller. Thanks so much, gang.
Thanks, David.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.